This ESPN Radio Daily Podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. To get a free quote on car insurance, call 1-800-PROGRESSIVE or visit progressive.com. You could save hundreds. Now that's Progressive. This is the ESPN Radio Daily Podcast.
Buster Olney, who I don't know how he has time to put together a blog for ESPN.com because he is constantly emailing me interesting baseball information. And our baseball insider joins us on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline. He gave you a tease earlier this hour telling you he was going to give you three difference-making players who will join the pennant races today. Buster, who are they?
Ian Kinsler of the Texas Rangers, been on the disabled list. They are struggling for offense, and maybe he'll be a guy who will stabilize their lineup. Cliff Lee rejoins the Seattle Mariners. And, you know, the whole thing about the Mariners coming into the year that we knew, if they were going to win their division, it was going to be because of the strength of Lee and Felix Hernandez at the front end of their rotation. They're hanging in there. Those four teams in the American League West, all within a game and a half of each other, and now Lee rejoins their rotation. And Brad Lidge rejoins the Phillies bullpen. You know, this week I talked to a scout who said that the greatest challenge that Phillies GM Ruben Amaro is going to have this summer is to sort of construct a good bullpen, a bullpen that can win in October. Going into today's games, the Phillies ranked 19th out of 30 teams in bullpen ERA. And with Lidge sliding in at the back end, theoretically, you know, they could be a lot better. But we'll see if he gets back to what he was in 2008 rather than what he was in 2009. I talked to him in spring training, and he feels like he's in a better place physically to be able to throw strikes.
Which of these players' injuries has the possibility of recurring during the year?
I think Ian Kinsler's, he has indicated reporters, the thing that he has kind of been bothering him for a while. And the Lidge injury is interesting because, you know, he talked about how once his knee started to bother him and he couldn't really pitch with the same mechanics he had in the past, it started to affect his arm. And what scouts felt like last year was he just could not throw the ball for strikes the way that he had in the past. He actually was throwing as hard as he had in the past, but just not with the ability to command the ball. So we'll see if there's any kind of recurrence of that.
Mike and Buster, Phil's hosting the Mets beginning today in what shapes up to be a very interesting early season series in the National League East. Both teams very much in the news. Let's start with the Mets, who just concluded as good a homestand as they've ever had pretty much in their franchise history. You look at the way their pitching has started this season. You look at the sort of jolt they got from bringing the kid up to play first base. Is this a team that's going to be there all summer long, Buster?
I think it all depends on one guy, and that's Mike Pelfrey, who has been the difference maker so far in their rotation. We knew going into the year with Santana at the front of the rotation, what they needed was a guy who could support him, be the strong number two. It seemed like in spring training, Oliver Perez had the best chance to be that guy. He hasn't been. Well, here comes Mike Pelfrey. You know, former number one pick who is an 0.69 ERA so far this year. He's not going to pitch at that level the whole year, but if he can be a strong number two, essentially to match Hamels with the Phillies, absolutely I think they can stay in this race.
And as far as the Phillies are concerned, we spent a lot of this week talking about the contract extension for Ryan Howard, 5 years, $25 million, tacked onto what he already had. Now that it's had a few days to settle in, what has the reaction around baseball been?
That people with other teams just do not understand it at all. Because you know, the Phillies could have waited, and they could have waited to avoid the risk that they now have with having that $164 million commitment. And the simple fact is they could have been in a position to command the group of free agent first basemen after the 2011 season with Prince Fielder, Adrian Gonzalez, Albert Pujols, and Ryan Howard, at one point all scheduled to become free agents after next year. And they simply didn't take advantage of their spot in the market. Now, you know, what the Phillies will tell you is they love Ryan Howard. They wanted to keep him. They thought his price would go up. I know a lot of people in a lot of other front offices disagree.
Saying in the National League, two teams with high expectations, Atlanta and L.A., both only have 8 wins. But the edge in bad right now goes to Atlanta. They've lost 9 in a row. What is wrong with this team, and can they get out of it?
Guys in the middle of the order are absolutely not getting it done. You know, Chipper Jones is, of course, going to the Hall of Fame someday. So far this year, his OPS, combined slugging on base percentage, .811. That is the lowest since he was a rookie. And he had to be a linchpin for their offense. And Troy Gloss was brought in to play first base. He has a 300 slugging percentage. And it feels like that what's happened is with those guys not really hitting the way that people expected them to, that there's been fraying around the edges. You know, Jason Heyward has had the typical ups and downs of a rookie. He's had stretches where he struck out a lot. And it just has frayed. And they are really struggling. And when you look at that lineup, unless Chipper Jones can get back to being what he's been in the past, boy, it's hard to see them being able to reconstruct everything.
Mike and Buster, only I got to give you some credit, Buster. Before the season began, you were telling me the Tampa Bay Rays are the best team in Major League Baseball, and I scoffed at you because that's my tendency. But I figured the Yankees and Red Sox ultimately would be the Yankees and Red Sox, and the Rays would be also Rams. But the Rays are not just beating people. They have the best record in the sport. They're crushing people. Talk about that a little bit.
Oh, last night we had Carl Crawford on Baseball Tonight. He did a phoner, and he said that the players on the Rays like to talk about themselves like the Phoenix Suns. Just keep running. In fact, you know, Dave Martinez, their bench coach, told me that every player on the Rays starts the game with the green light on the bases. And recently an opposing pitcher walked over toward the Rays before a game as they were warming up and stretching, and he said, "I hate playing you guys because all you do is run." It puts pressure on certainly opposing pitchers. It makes it easier for hitters. If you look at what they've done with runners on base, they're hitting .338 with runners in scoring position, and a lot of that is simply because opposing pitchers, opposing catchers are completely distracted by what they're doing. So far this year, their run differential is plus +69. They remind me in the way they're beating teams now. The way the 98 Yankees were beating teams, and a team I covered, were just every day they were just crushing teams. That's what the Rays are doing right now. And you talk about a team in for a long weekend. The Kansas City Royals last night started a four-game series with the Rays with their bullpen beat up. They were beaten 11-1 last night, and I promise you there'll be a lot more of that over the weekend.
You said plus +69, their differential. Next closest is a team that's trailing on the Yankees. They're plus +37, so a long ways away. How about Boston, who is next, is six games back? They're minus 15 in that category. Can they catch Tampa Bay? Will it have to be something they do, or will Tampa Bay have to falter?
Well, Tampa Bay certainly has to stop playing like a juggernaut.
Well, they can't keep up this pace. I mean,
right. You wouldn't think so, but I can tell you this. I mean, this is a very well-rounded team. They've got great starting pitching. Every starting pitcher for them has an ERA 3.60 or less. They all have plus stuff. They just have this incredible depth in their roster. But, yeah, I agree with you. They probably will slow down, and Boston just simply has to get better pitching from guys like Josh Beckett. And it's interesting because I think Theo Epstein, the Red Sox GM, among a lot of GMs, he would be a guy who's not going to pour paint down a hole if he doesn't think it's going to work. In other words, if the Red Sox are 8-10 games behind the Rays in midseason, Theo's not going to trade a bunch of prospects to try to salvage what he really believes is a lost season. I mean, he will take a step back, and we've seen him in the past make changes when he just didn't think his team was good enough.
He is Robert Stanberry, only the third, Buster Olney, on baseball every Monday and Friday, and usually every other day as well, here on Mike and Mike in the Morning. Thank you, Buster.
See you guys.
To compare car insurance rates from top insurers in one easy place, visit Progressive.com today. You could save hundreds. Now that's Progressive.
Certainly one thing they'll be talking about tomorrow will be the 136th running of the Kentucky Derby. The coverage will actually be right here on ESPN Radio. You'll hear the race live tomorrow, the coverage from 5 to 7 Eastern Time. Brent Musburger will be the host of our coverage with Jody McDonald and our buddy Jerry Bailey doing the analysis. Jerry Bailey, the legendary jockey who joins us on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline. Jerry, welcome to Mike and Mike. How are you this morning?
Good, guys. How are you?
Good. Good to talk to you. Usually we're down there for the race,
right.
And so sorry we're not sitting there face-to-face. But let's start with the big story, which is the morning line favorite, looking at Lucky. In the post-draw, things did not go well. Drawing the rail, no one has won the Derby from the rail in almost 25 years. So how big a factor in your mind is that?
Well, if everything goes right at the break, it's not a factor at all. It's actually a very good post. The problem with a post like number one, if there is a mishap when the gates open, if he stumbles, if he breaks a little bit slow, if a horse breaks into his path, the whole field could collapse in front of him, and then it becomes a problem for him.
Now, next in line, as far as odds are concerned, Sydney's Candy is on the outside. Now, Big Brown won from that position in 2008, but how difficult is it to come from the outside?
Well, it is difficult to a degree, but Sidney's Candy is a horse that's been winning all of his races on the lead. He's never had dirt in his face, and he does possess a great amount of speed. Having said that, all Talamoa's jockey has to do is get him out there and then get him over right in behind the speed, but he's got to use him a little bit to do that before he gets to that first turn. Now, how much he uses him depends on how fast the rest of the horses is, and the end result is whatever he uses early, he's going to pay for late. So it's a small issue, but I don't think it's going to cost him the race.
Jerry Bailey with us again tomorrow, the coverage of the Kentucky Derby right here on ESPN Radio. So those are the two horses that we've been hearing the most about, Looking at Lucky and Sidney's Candy. Who else do you have an eye on?
Well, Pletcher lost a big favorite, Escondrea, earlier in the week, but he's still got four in, and two of them have a very good chance. Mission Impassable and the filly he entered, Devil May Care, coming out of the 11 for the filly and I believe 16 for Mission Impassable, or 14 for Mission Impassable. Both horses have an excellent chance and a long shot, two long shots from the crew here. You got Patio Prado and Stately Victor.
And as far as what's the thought on the weather, what's the weather supposed to be like, and how could that impact the race?
We're start to build our arc today. It's not how much rain we're going to get. I mean, if we're going to get it, but how much. It's what, 2 to 3 inches of rain at least coming in tonight and through the morning tomorrow.
It's going to be a great day. It always is. I'm sorry we're not down there for it. Jerry, thanks for jumping in. Enjoy the day tomorrow. We'll be listening.
Hi, guys. Thank you.
Jerry Bailey with us here on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline. Again, I feel kind of sad. 3 years in a row we've been down there for the race, and with just all the scheduling things going on, we weren't able to get down there this year. But that is a fun event.
It's a great time.
To,
and
yeah.
Right after our show, the first thing we do is run and get our, make our bets for the races going on there. I enjoy it. I have a great time there.
The 136th Kentucky Derby again tomorrow right here on ESPN Radio.
We do it every day at this time. We call it our daily sports page.
Spanning the globe to bring you the constant variety of sports.
Spanning the globe. Dallas.
All right, the Mavs get eliminated early by the Spurs. There's a lot of angst in Dallas with Mark Cuban and Mike Peasley, FM 103.3 in Dallas. I mean, I don't know. Do you blame somebody? I mean, is Cuban to blame? Don Nelson? I mean, what do you say about this?
Well, Colin, there certainly is a lot of blame going around here in the Metroplex today. One of the guys getting a lot of the blame is Coach Rick Carlisle for the way he has handled the rotation. Caron Butler didn't play at all in the second half in Game 3. And, of course, Butler had big Game 5 and Game 6. So you see Carlisle also getting criticized for the way he did not play Roddy Bobois, the rookie guard. He had 16 points in just over 21 minutes. Jason Terry getting a lot of the blame as well for not showing up in the postseason. He made just one shot last night. And Jason Kidd also takes, as well, 43 minutes and just one field goal. So it's plenty of blame to go around right now as the Mavericks lose in the first round for the third time in the last 4 years. Cuban bad for Dirk Nowitzki as Dirk trying to get him a ring. And Dirk talked after the game last night. There's a possibility he's looking at his options of possibly opting out. He's got a $21.5 million deal. I don't think he will opt out next year, but kind of surprising that Dirk said he was going to look at his options.
Wow, Mike Peasley, FM 103.3 in Dallas, freaking out in Mavstown. Appreciate it, Mike.
Thank you, Colin.
Horse racing.
Derby's tomorrow, Kentucky Derby, 5 to 7 Eastern on ESPN Radio. Randy Moss, ESPN horse racing analyst. Overall, is it a good field this year, Randy?
Overall, Colin, the answer would be no. The horse Escondrea, who was going to be the heavy favorite before he got hurt, had real star quality, superstar quality even. But now that he's out, the rest of the field, not that eye-catching, but it's an evenly matched race. It ought to be fun to watch.
So if that's the case, shouldn't I like the favorite? Shouldn't I like somebody tied to the rail then?
Well, the favorite, Looking at Lucky, the problem is the rail might not be the best spot for him because he is trouble-prone. In his last two races, they almost put him over the rail both times. He's the kind of horse that it's like some of these NFL football players. They seem to find trouble wherever they go, and Looking at Lucky has been that way in his last couple of starts. The rail can be awfully crowded, so you don't know what he's going to happen.
Weather's going to be cruddy, is it not, Randy?
Weather's going to be horrible, Colin. Horrible. Rain of biblical proportions is what they're talking about. They're talking like 5-6 inches of rain in a 24-hour period at Churchill Downs, so... Now, we may need a boat to get to the track tomorrow, and it's definitely, if the weather, man, is handicapping this ride, it's definitely going to be one of those sloppy tracks.
Good talking to you, Randy.
All right, Colin, take care.
Phoenix.
How good is round two of the NBA playoffs? Cavs and the Celtics, and the Suns meet the Spurs. There's going to be a lot of hate in that room. Paul Calvisi, KTAR. Boy, I'll tell you, Jason Richardson, when they went and got him, when Steve Kerr went and got him, they got him for series like this. He has become, I mean, talk about Jason Richardson, how big he's become for the Suns.
You know what? You can talk about Steve Nash and Amar'e Stoudemire all you want, but you're exactly right, Colin, because I think the stat is, since he came over in the trade, when he goes for 20 or more points, the Suns are now 43-9. And what you saw in Game 1 was a Blazers team that stunned the Suns, and a lot of it had to do with Jason Richardson on Andre Miller. And basically, as we termed it, he couldn't multitask. He couldn't guard Andre Miller, who went for 31 in Game 1, and actually be the scorer he needs to be for the Suns. So they took him off Andre Miller. I've never seen one move dictate an outcome of a series like that. They put Grant Hill on Andre Miller. He was so bad last night, he got benched in the fourth quarter. He was 0 for his last 7. Meantime, Jason Richardson went off, had a 42-point game, and he is the wild card. And he knows it. And if there's any direct correlation to the Suns winning games, it's when Jason Richardson scores 20 or more.
The Suns have lacked an identity, Paul, at times. Do they have one? I mean, if I said, what's a sentence to describe the Suns? Do they have that identity now?
You know, new and improved, I guess, would be it. It was shocking to us to hear the Blazers fans calling the Suns dirty. I mean, that's when we knew we had a different Suns team, as they were all mad because the Suns were actually, wait a minute, being physical. It is a different team than it was under Mike D'Antoni. They actually play a trace of defense. Last night was the second game in the series. They held the Blazers to 38% shooting from the field. They're using many more players. You know, D'Antoni would go only with a 7-man rotation in the playoffs. I mean, Alvin Gentry will go with 10 guys, as we saw last night, not even including Robin Lopez, who might be back for this series. If the 7-footer can go and harass Tim Duncan a little bit, I think that'll be huge for the Suns. I mean, but just to hear the Blazers fans and the media get all over the Suns as being dirty, that's how you know they're different, if nothing else.
Good stuff, Paul. Good talking to you. KTAR. Okay. Thanks, bud.
Yep, anytime, Colin.
That was Spanning the Globe.
To bring you the constant variety of sports.
The Herd on ESPN Radio.
NFL draft analyst Mel Kiper Jr. And Mel, you and I started this tradition, and I'm kind of happy it's blown up and gotten popular. You see a lot of people doing this now. 4 years ago, we said, okay, who's your top three guys for 2011? And you started out by saying, okay, we're going to go seniors only because you don't know what juniors are going to declare. But now it's kind of become a thing. You and I did it 4 years ago. Now, you know, you do it. Todd McShay does it. Everybody. Mm-hmm. I feel like we started this whole thing, who's your top three for next year's draft? I kind of feel, I'm glad we're on the ground floor of this, buddy.
Jason Smith's a trailblazer. I already said that. It's not the Portland Trailblazers, it's the Jason Smith Trailblazers. And yeah, you start these things. You had the foresight before anybody else does to come up with different ideas, and we did 4 years ago. And I think this year, and I've said last year, we have to include juniors because you have to go apples to apples. If somebody else is coming out early, you can't come out with his seniors, because then you're, again, like I said with the Ravens, you can't draft a cornerback safety if you think he's just going to be average. So I don't want to put guys up there, not that they're going to be average, but guys up there that aren't what these juniors are and don't have as high a grade. So I'll go down. I'll go three down to one. How's that? We'll start out.
Okay, three down to one. So the the last guy you're going to give me is who you think is going to be the number one pick in the draft next year.
Yep, number three.
All right, very good.
Yeah, I'm going to go a 2A quarterback, and I've never liked doing this, but if he comes out and after having a great year, and he needs to have a great year, and he's only going to be a third-year sophomore. He's a quarterback out at Stanford by the name of Andrew Luck. So we remember Oliver Luck at West Virginia and then in the NFL. That's his father. Andrew Luck, quarterback out of Stanford, has the skill level and the talent and all the makeup you need, and he's got some excellent receivers to throw to, okay? Doesn't have Toby Gerhardt running the football to lean on, but he's got some excellent receivers in that passing game to throw to. Veteran offensive line coming back at Stanford. I think he can have the kind of year that even after a third year, as a third year sophomore, could come out, and I'm going to put him number three right now on the big board.
You know, it's funny because I'm going to enjoy seeing all the video of Oliver Luck in the draft next year, because all I remember seeing from Oliver Luck, it seems like he was in every one of those football follies videos when the Oilers were really bad and he was in games and fumbling or getting sacked and the ball was bouncing all over the place. I'm going to enjoy seeing that video at next year's draft.
I'll tell you, it's just amazing. People are saying, even when we were talking about this on draft day and after, when you go back to the fathers, now we have the sons, right? Are we going to have... Am I going to be around long enough to have grandfathers, fathers, and then grandsons? It's amazing, Jace. Now I got I'm going through so many fathers and now that you scouted. You scouted the fathers, now we're scouting the sons, and then all of a sudden, 20 years from now, or however many years from now, we're going to have It's going to be amazing. It's like I know I'm old now, but when you talk about it, you can feel older.
All right, buddy, who's your number two pick right now?
Number two on the big board is a defensive end at North Carolina by the name of Robert Quinn. 6'4", and change, 267 pounds, clocks in the 4'5 range, freakish talent, off the edge, virtually unstoppable, should be a dominant pass rusher this year. He's got Marvin Austin to occupy inside, who will be a senior defensive tackle. Marvin Austin conceivably could be a top 10 pick if he becomes consistent week to week. He's got awesome talent. He's been starting since his freshman year. Heavily recruited out of high school. So we got Marvin Austin inside, collapsing the pocket, again, getting into that backfield and commanding the double teams, occupying that center guard, that old AB gap and that all that stuff. And then you go out to Robert Quinn coming off the edge. That's as good a 1-2 punch along the defensive front as anybody I've seen in recent memory. And Robert Quinn is a defensive end. He'll be a junior. Watch out for him. He is a spectacular pass rush talent. If he has the kind of year expected, then he's going to be way up there. He'll be my number two guy going in.
ESPN's Mel Kiper Jr. previewing the top three picks of the 2011 draft with us. It's All Might with Jason Smith on ESPN Radio and ESPNRadio.com. Now, your number one guy, Mel, I'm thinking it's between two guys.
Okay.
And knowing what I know, what you've talked to me about and we've talked about the last few months, if I got to pick between what I think is going to be a choice between Jake Locker and Ryan Mallett, I'm thinking you're going to go with Jake Locker.
You know me too well. Ryan Mallett, quarterback at Arkansas, is at number six on the big board. And he's a guy, tall, big, strong arm, powerful arm, mobile for his size. He made some bad decisions on some throws and needs to do a better job in that area. But Bobby Petrino is his second year, and I have great respect for Bobby Petrino and his ability to develop quarterbacks and in that offense just put up incredible numbers. Ryan Mallett's got a chance to have a huge year. And he loves football, and I got him number six on the board. But you're right, Jake Locker, quarterback at Washington, is number one. I would think that with the year he's capable of having, keep in mind, the Washington Huskies aren't what USC has been in terms of talent around the quarterback. So he deals in a different situation. He carries this football team. He's the main entity. He's the big, strong-arm kid with the athleticism and the toughness and all that. If he has the kind of year he's capable of, it's hands down. And I can say this, and Todd McShay made that point, and I concur. Had he come out this year, he could have been number one. If he wasn't number one, had at worst been number four. And had he come out, I think history would have been a little rewritten. And I say it for this reason. I'm not so sure that if Jake Locker's in this draft with Sam Bradford, that the Washington Redskins don't just say, at number four, we're getting one of these two guys.
All right, speculate this for me a little bit here now. On paper right now, the 2011 quarterback class, is it better than the 2010 quarterback class?
Well, you're going to have three players in the top six on the big board going in. Last year, if you go in, Sam Bradford was the number one guy going in. Of course, then he was injured. Then he dropped to four or five on the big board because you wanted to see how that shoulder injury was. Jimmy Clausen, I had it four. A lot of people didn't. And obviously on draft day, he went in the second round. People say, well, your ratings don't matter. I don't care where I had a kid rated. It doesn't mean you're way off. Who cares? I mean, if I had him 4 or 14, he went 48. You're going to be off at 14. Does it really matter? If you had him 14, you were in line with what a lot of people had. And you know what, Jace? This is, again, where we look at the craziness of the draft and the craziness of what goes on. I say craziness, the intrigue of this whole process. Jimmy Clausen went 48. And I think I heard Morton Adams Schefter talk about this. Mort said, Seattle doesn't see Earl Thomas there. Philadelphia would take, say, Earl Thomas instead of Brandon Graham. Seattle speculated, not known for sure, but it's been speculated that they would have taken Jimmy Clausen possibly at 14. And he wouldn't have been around for Carolina at 48. So that's how things change. Just one move there changed things. And you mentioned who was the quarterback that slid. The only one I ever had that high that slid was Boomer Esiason. Boomer Esiason had a very high grade back in 1984. Cincinnati Bengals took three players in the first round, didn't take him, took him in the second round, and he had a heck of a career. So, Brett Favre, I had gone 20th in the first round. He went in the second round, had a great career. So these things have happened before, but I'd compare this more to Boomer than Brett. Brett was 20 into the 30s, okay? This, Boomer was into the second round when you're talking maybe top five, top pick overall. So, again, if it works out for Jimmy Clausen like it did for Boomer Esiason and Brett Favre, the Carolina Panthers and Jimmy Clausen and all his supporters are going to be very happy.
He's ESPN NFL draft guru Mel Kiper Jr. Mel, as always, my friend, appreciate our conversations. I hope you enjoy some well-deserved time off. Look forward to talking to you later on this summer, my friend.
Well, I always say see you in September, Chase, because there was a song, See You in September, but I will see you in early August when we pick it up for like the 16th year, it seems like, doing this. I know it's not that many, but it's been a lot of fun, Chase, and nobody does it better.
You got it, buddy. Thank you very much. You too. Enjoy your summer, and unless Beano Cook says something about you, I'll talk to you then.
Oh, yeah, he will. You know that.
You know Beano too well, but you and I know each other, and we know Beano, so I'm sure that's going
to
happen.
Oh, I can't wait to talk to Beano. In fact, I may give him a call tomorrow and get a little preview from Beano on who his national champion is going to be.
You got it, buddy. We'll talk to you soon, my
friend. See you, Jay. Take care, pal.
Joining us now, man who blogs about the NFC West for ESPN.com, Mike Sando. Mike, who set ESPN.com afire with something he said earlier this week. We'll get to that in a couple of seconds. But first thing, Mike, all things considered with Walter Jones, what I just said about him, is he a Hall of Famer?
Yeah, you know, I joined the voting process for the Hall of Fame this past year, and so I have an appreciation for the fact that there's a lot of really good players who get left by the wayside, including Shannon Sharpe this last year. I think we all would agree as a Hall of Fame player. So you can't guarantee anything, but I can come pretty close to saying that he's going to get in really quickly because, really, I think we're talking about Jonathan Ogden, Orlando Pace, Walter Jones as the three class tackles of the last 15, 20 years, and arguably Walter Jones is as accomplished as either one of them with the 9 Pro Bowls, 4 first-team All-Pro, went to a Super Bowl, played on really the best teams in Seahawks history. And the thing about it was he just did it quietly. You know, he never was a guy you saw on TV doing interviews. This is not his style. He never talked trash to opponents. But I think in the end, all that stuff almost made him, you know, respected even more because he didn't draw attention to himself. He just got the job done and played well and at a high level every year.
Boy, it certainly seems like this is the official end of the old era, beginning of the new era week. You had it started off with the big trades that Pete Carroll made and coming off the draft that everybody loves. And here Walter Jones, one of the last of the old guard, retires. Really seems like it's time for that new chapter for Seattle.
It is. I believe Walter Jones is the last player in Seattle who came in under the Dennis Erickson regime. So we really are, you know, out with the old here. And so, certainly I think in St. Louis, you know, with Sam Bradford coming in, you really get the feeling too. And I don't know how fast they're going to be able to turn it around, but, they have a fresh face. You know, I think the Mark Bulger experiment was so far past, reclamation that they just needed to turn over a new leaf and start fresh. And so he symbolically gives them that. And, you know, I think really on the field too, is going to as well.
As far as the Rams go with Bradford, obviously it's going to be a big push to get him to play early. Maybe the plan is for A.J. Feely to hand the reins over. What's their plan going into minicamp?
Yeah, you know, when you talk about the Rams, you have guys on the coaching staff who are with Andy Reid in Philadelphia for a long time, including Pat Shurmur, the offensive coordinator, was the quarterback's coach there and had been with Reid from the beginning. And so when you look back at what they did with Donovan McNabb, I think it can tell you sort of where they would like to head. And remember way back then they brought in Doug Peterson, you know, a guy who nobody had really heard of, was a journeyman backup. And he started, I think, a half dozen games that first year, and then they felt comfortable bringing McNabb in. And so I can't imagine that they would throw Bradford to the wolves in week one. It's just too much to ask. And you can damage guys. Look at Alex Smith in San Francisco. I mean, he's still trying to recover from being thrown out there too early coming from a spread offense. So I think we can expect certainly a handful of games, maybe in half the season, depending on how well it goes, before they really, you know, put Sam Bradford under center in a real game.
See, it's funny because I'm kind of the opposite way. I think, you know, obviously when you take a guy that's picked number one overall, a team is starting from the bottom, but they have a decent offensive line in place. You know, we've seen that the last couple of years. Even though they were bad, their own line is good. So I think they could even say, hey, we can put Bradford out there, not worry he's going to be David Carr and wind up on his back 65 times this season. So I think that might push them to start him a little bit sooner.
Yeah, you know, I give you a lot of credit, actually, for appreciating the offensive line in St. Louis, because it is pretty good. Now, they were so injured down the stretch last year on the offensive line that it was problematic, and I think it prevented them from building on some of the progress that was being made, not in the standings, but on the field. And so this year, you know, they draft Roger Saffold at the top of the second round. I think you're right. They do have a better offensive line, And Steven Jackson, you know, is an excellent running back. They don't really have the tight end situation, you know, solved as far as having an established security blanket. The receivers, I think they feel okay about, but there's nothing there really where you say, yeah, that guy's definitely going to be good. And so it could be a feel thing. I mean, you could be right. If they felt good enough about their offense coming out of training camp, you know, and early in the season with that offensive line, maybe you consider doing it earlier. I just think you have to be careful not to do it too soon, because if he gets broken early or gets hurt, I mean, that's been kind of the knock on him, you know, at Oklahoma the last year. The damage could be, you know, tough to overcome.
ESPN.com NFC West blogger Mike Sando was with us. It's All Night with Jason Smith on ESPN Radio and ESPNRadio.com. Mike, in case you don't know, Mike probably just lost all his visiting privileges to the state of Arizona, but yet to the city of San Francisco, he will be extended the olive branch. Mike, you picked earlier this week, you think San Francisco is going to outlast Arizona and win the NFC West. I'm sure you've gotten mail from both of those cities saying you're great and I hate you. Take me a little bit behind your decision to back the Niners here.
Well, you know, if you looked at them last season, they were a team that was kind of, you know, close, couldn't quite win the games they had to. They made it to 500 for the first time since Jeff Garcia was quarterback, and they owned the Cardinals. I mean, they beat the Cardinals twice, and they really almost swept them the year before. Remember, there was that Monday night game where it came down to the weird ending, and they couldn't quite get it done from, like, the two-yard line, but they sort of had their number, and so I think until we see more from Matt Leinart, who started only one game last season, I think it's fair to say that the 49ers probably should win this division. Now, I'm not writing off Arizona. I'm hedging the bets a little bit because I think they have performed very well when people have written them off, and I think they're very well coached. I just don't know that I can quite, you know, endorse them again this far out until we have a feel for how well Matt Leinart's going to play, and I think he has a lot to prove this season, and the pressure should be off in some ways because Kurt Warner's gone and not looking over his shoulder, but he has to play well and better than he did in a lot of the sort of backup stints, mop-up duty when he went in last season.
He's ESPN.com NFC West blogger Mike Sando, his latest on the front of the NFL page on ESPN.com. Mike, as always, appreciate your time with us on All Night. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
We'd like to thank you for listening to today's show. For more great podcasts, check out the Pod Center page at ESPNRadio.com.